Bonjour and bienvenue to Battle Royale, where we are passing judgment on all the kings and emperors of France from Clovis to Napoleon III.
Who will be selected as the creme de la creme and who will be sent to the guillotine?
Je m'appelle Ben Clark.
And I'm Eliza Summers.
And today we are talking about Anne of France. Also known as Anne de Beaujeu, if you're trying to Google her. She was the daughter of our last king, Louis the 11th, but unfortunately not the Queen of France, because there will never be a Queen of France in her own right. But she is the elder sister of a king of, both the daughter and the elder sister of a king of France. She's not very well known. As a historical figure, she's often one of these like footnote afterthought kind of people. But these are always my like favorite people to talk about on the podcast, I think. Because it's sort of you're shining a light on, a hidden gem.
A dusty pearl.
Before we do an episode, I often look to see like if there are any other podcasts about this person. I didn't find any for Anne at all.
Wow.
Not a one episode from anyone.
Not even the Queen's podcast?
No, they haven't done her.
Oh, wow.
She's not a queen. So maybe that would be a hindrance. So let's get into her life. Anne of France was born on the 3rd of April, 1461, to Charlotte of Savoy, Queen of France, and her husband, King Louis the 11th, the Universal Spider.
Yes.
Subject of last episode. Anne was named for her maternal grandmother, Anne de Lusignan, who was a Duchess of Savoy. And Anne, as we have previously learned, comes from the Hebrew word for grace. And it's been common in Western Europe since the marriage of Anne of Kiev to Henry I of France in the 11th century.
Still common today.
Yes. And one of the reasons is because Anne is the name of the Virgin Mary's mother. So she's a very important saint. So Anne was the third born child of Louis and Charlotte, but she was the first to live beyond her first year. And at the time of her birth, her parents were not quite yet the king and queen, her grandfather, Charles VII, still being alive. And she was born in exile at the castle of Genappe in Brabant, because you remember Louis the 11th and his dad not get along. So they're living just outside of what is technically France at this time, modern day Belgium, that sort of area. And that's where Anne is born. However, when Anne was about 3 months old, her grandfather, King Charles, dies. So Louis becomes king and the family moves their new royal court to France. Anne's childhood was spent predominantly in the Loire Valley at the Chateau d'Amboise. And this is a popular haunt for kings and will continue to be popular pretty much all the way up until Versailles becomes a thing.
Yeah.
And this was mainly the Queen's residence at Amboise. This is also where Anne's younger siblings are born and where she grew up tended by a whole slew of servants. She had a maid of honor, two chambermaids, several wet nurses, and a royal cradle rocker.
Oh, damn, a royal cradle rocker.
Yeah, and this is all just for Anne.
Damn.
Yeah. So during Louis the 11th's reign, the royal children, they grew up safe and sound, sort of separated from the perils of court life and like the intricate webs of the Spider King. They were kind of in their own separate sort of sphere. And the king was usually either at his favorite residence at the Chateau du Plessis, a few miles away from Amboise, or he was like on progress somewhere else in the kingdom.
Yeah.
But Anne and her siblings mainly just resided at Amboise. So Anne was kept out of the spotlight, but Louis, he wasn't necessarily a neglectful father, as he's sometimes been portrayed.
More just a busy father.
He was busy, and he was mainly concerned with keeping his children safe.
Yeah.
Because he had a lot of enemies.
Yeah.
And also, they were valuable bargaining chips for him. So, you know, probably a mix of paternal affection and, you know,
power.
And Louis was constantly dangling the prospect of marrying his eldest daughter in front of the other great princes of Europe, as you do. As you have to do as the king. So at age 4, Anne was proposed to marry Charles the Bold, the Duke of Burgundy, who was in his 30s.
Ew.
And her dowry was supposed to consist of 1.2 million gold crowns and champagne. Not the drink, the duchy.
Aw. Damn. I was like, oh.
I guess it's a county, but the whole county of one of the richest counties in France, as well as over a million gold crowns. This did not go through, as Louis and Burgundy were constantly at each other's throats. They would never be able to agree on anything. Louis ended up offering Anne instead to Burgundy's enemy, Duke Nicholas of Lorraine.
Love that.
But Lorraine kind of wanted to reconcile with Burgundy because he decided he wanted to marry Charles the Bald's daughter, Mary the Rich. Because if you remember, he only has a daughter and she's the one who ends up inheriting Burgundy. So Lorraine abandons the marriage with Anne and goes for Mary. And this pisses off Louis the 11th, who then apparently poisons Lorraine. So he dies.
Like, you reject my girl, you reject my daughter.
Yeah. So as Anne grew up, as the constant center of political bargaining, she became notable for two things. Firstly, her resemblance to her father in her sort of shrewdness and her prudence, as well as her sort of no-nonsense approach to life.
Sound like Princess Anne a bit.
Well, she is Princess Anne.
Yeah, I know, Princess Anne, you know, modern day.
Yeah, she does. You're right. She kind of does.
Yeah.
Well, like current Princess Anne, she is known to be a very skilled horsewoman. Very skilled equestrian. This is also something she says she has in common with her father, who's very keen on hunting. So Anne inherits that. Anne also inherits a kind of distaste for royal extravagance. So she later wrote that she saw excessive clothing, for instance, as, quote, offensive to the creator, and that, quote, a dress, no matter how beautiful, can't make the wrinkles on a woman's face disappear.
True, though.
So she's got the sass of Louis. But Anne's best traits probably come from her mother, who, if you remember, Charlotte was not very involved in politics, but she was a big bookworm. Yeah. And she kept up the Valois tradition of book collecting. And Anne carried this forward. And she later actually wrote a book herself, which we'll get to.
Oh, nice.
But Anne was better at demonstrating sort of pleasantness and compassion than Louis the 11th's one. She had the woman's touch, you might say. Although her enemies always said this was just a mask for her dastardly cunning, which was no different from her father.
I love that, though.
So probably because she resembled him so much, Anne ended up being the clear favorite of Louis's children, although there's not much competition in that regard. So of her siblings, five had died in infancy, and her surviving sister, Jeanne, was considered physically malformed, and her brother, Charles, was considered ugly, sickly, and mentally stunted. So, you know, the centuries of inbreeding, they're starting to pay dividends. Yes. But Anne was the lucky one. She will also outlive both her siblings by a matter of decades.
Yeah.
So by the time baby Charles was born, Anne was 11 years old, and the marriage prospects have progressed. She's now fully betrothed to the man that she will finally marry a couple of years later in 1473. So she's 13 when she gets married. The man she marries is 35.
Ew.
And his name is Pierre de Bourbon. He's the younger brother of two very important men, the Duke of Bourbon and the Archbishop of Lyon. If we remember, the Bourbon family rules this fairly big principality that's just south of the Loire Valley.
Yes.
Yeah. If you put your finger right in the middle of France, you're hitting the Bourbon territories.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And as the king's new son-in-law, Pierre joins the royal council as the Lieutenant General of France. And he and Anne moved to her father's court at Plessy. So she's not moving down to Bourbon. She's actually moving to her father's court.
Nice.
And it's during her teenage years that Anne kind of gets to know her father, gets to know how the country is run.
Yeah.
Quickly develops a kind of political savvy from quite a young age.
Nice.
And Louis the 11th is said to have pronounced Anne to be, quote, the least foolish of all women. Unfortunately, Louis was not the... He was a bit of a misogynist. He said that there were no wise women, but Anne was the least foolish.
God.
Yeah. Friendly reminder that we are in the 15th century.
True, true.
So the Bourbon family in this period, politically, they're kind of useless. Like since the War of the Public Weal, the big rebellion against Louis, they kind of have been not doing much, kind of being loyal, sitting in the back. They lacked the kind of cutthroat ambition of their Valois cousins. But they were a big, rich family with loads of wealth. While they aren't brilliant advisors, it's good to keep their resources on the king's side.
Yeah.
And part of the motivation for Anne's match to Pierre in particular was to break off a betrothal between Pierre and the Duke of Orléans' sister, Marie. So Louis wanted to drive a wedge between these two houses that he was afraid might unite against him. So Louis distrusted and feared the growing influence of the new young Duke of Orléans, who's his second cousin, who is also called Louis. And he's sort of far younger and more handsome and increasingly more popular with the people. He's the son of Charles the Poet, who was also very popular. But at this point, Orléans is still just reaching adulthood.
Yeah.
So Louis XI, he prevents the Bourbon-Orléans alliance to stop the princes ganging up on him. And for good measure, he also forces Orléans into a betrothal with his second daughter, Jeanne. The, quote, deformed one. And Louis believes that, if you remember from Louis XI's episode, Louis believed that this would extinguish the Orléans line. So it was a very cruel move on his part. But cruel to both his daughter and to Orléans, in a way.
Yeah, making his daughter hated by her husband.
Exactly. It's pretty diabolical.
It really is.
But back to Anne's marriage, it was a lot more successful.
Okay.
So despite the age gap, they weren't a bad match.
Okay.
At least by comparison to her unfortunate sister. Pierre de Bourbon, despite being far older, his personality was rather meek and humble compared to his more assertive wife. She's usually considered to have worn the trousers in this relationship, as Pierre constantly defers to her judgment, particularly as he enters old age. Yeah, and starts to become a bit more infirm.
Decrepit. Sorry, I just love saying that word. Any time I can throw in decrepit, I will.
And one writer says that to name Pierre is also to name Anne. So if you say, if you're saying, like, you know, Pierre has voted this way in the council, it's like, it means that Anne's voted that way. So as a wedding gift, Anne received the county of Jean from the king to rule in her own right. While the Duke of Bourbon gave Pierre the small province of Beaujolais, which is a beautiful and famous wine region, which the Bourbon family had nabbed from Burgundy during the collapse of Burgundy. So with the local capital of Beaujeu as the seat of their new fiefdom, Anne and Pierre henceforth become known as the Lord and Lady of Beaujeu. And that's how they usually refer to. Together as the Beaujeus is generally how they're talked about, because, you know, to name one is to name the other. They're a real unit. And as a married woman, Anne was now more in the public eye, and she became known as Madame La Grande, the first lady of the kingdom, basically. By this point, her mother, Queen Charlotte, was still alive, but she was increasingly withdrawn from politics as her health deteriorated in the 1470s, and she ended up dying very shortly after King Louis. Now, children-wise, Anne wasn't quite so successful. She first becomes pregnant when she's about 14 or 15, and the resulting son was probably either miscarried or stillborn. Although we do have conflicting records saying it was a boy named Charles who lived into his 20s, which is quite different. But
that really is.
Yeah. But after this point, we don't hear anything about Anne having children or bearing children or being a mother.
Oh, wow.
Until later. We'll get to it.
Okay.
But there's a big gap where she's not pregnant for any of it. So in 1483, 10 years into the Beaujeu's marriage, Louis XI lay on his deathbed, and he decided to reward their loyalty by giving them custody over the 13-year-old Dauphin Charles.
Smart move.
And this is big, because you come of age in France at this time at the age of 14, and Charles is just short of his 14th birthday. When Louis dies. So whoever has custody of the king basically rules the kingdom.
Well, he did say she was smart.
So they're all safely tucked away together in their childhood home at Amboise. Which, by the way, I've been to Amboise. It's fantastic. It's a fantastic castle.
Nice.
And actually, Charles, later in his life, makes it more extravagant.
Fantastic.
But it's this beautiful, like, garden castle that's just, like, elevated on a plateau like above the River Loire. It's gorgeous. Nice. But it's very well, it's very secure. Like, you wouldn't be able to attack it very easily. So it's the perfect place to put this safe royal nursery. And it becomes the center of power in the new reign, because Anne creates a court there.
Nice.
So even though King Louis ordered that a regency council be put in place, consisting of Pierre de Beaujeu and a number of other lords, really, with this transfer of custody, he was letting the world know that Anne was going to be the true power behind the throne.
Yes.
However, while Anne did hold the trump card, the custody over the king, she certainly wasn't about to succeed unopposed. There were going to be some jerky men who had some problems. Throughout the kingdom, people, as they do, sort of held their breath for the king to die. And when he did, all hell broke loose.
Of course.
The monster's dead. The evil king is dead. Ding dong.
Spiders.
Munchkins dancing in the streets. Like, they're very happy.
Ding dong, witch is dead. Witch, old witch, wicked witch.
And officials, monks, priests throughout France, they contested people who had been appointed or laws that had been instated by Louis the 11th. People who'd been afraid to sort of raise their heads and rebel during the old king's reign suddenly felt emboldened by the perceived weakness of the crown.
A woman.
Chief among these discontent men was Pope Sixtus IV. Who, along with his predecessor, Pius II, had a lot of disputes with Louis the 11th. Pius had even threatened to excommunicate him. Sixtus supports changes in France, which just further embolden these people.
Mm.
The Beaujeus, meanwhile, are just trying to uphold the policies of Louis the 11th. Because they, even though they could be rather harsh, they worked pretty well. So to greatly oversimplify these disputes between the crown and the Pope, they were once again about the king advocating liberty and independence for local church authorities, which is a thing that we've seen since Charles VII's reign. So the Pope was trying to impose authority from afar, but the king was saying, like, just let them do whatever they want. And this very conveniently made them more loyal to the king. So this isn't quite the same as the earlier investiture crisis, where the Pope and the king or the emperor were arguing over which of them appointed clerics. The French monarchs of this period instead chose to support the liberty of the French church.
Yeah.
So he's saying the French clergy can elect each other without having to appeal to the Pope every single time, because that's inefficient.
Yeah, take forever.
It's also laying the Pope with too much power in France. And this is a very popular policy. So while Anne does face a lot of opposition from people who have lost out because of this policy, there are also still a lot of people who do support her.
Yeah.
And Anne is able to draw together these supporters of the regime at Amboise.
Nice.
And we'll get to how she maybe makes the court a more inviting place than Louis the Spider King made it. Although the Beaujeus tried their best to arrange a reconciliation with Pope Sixtus, the dispute remained unresolved. The French kind of end up getting away with these policies, while things down in Italy are getting very chaotic.
Boiling.
And we'll kind of get more into that in a future episode when a certain king may or may not go to Italy.
Yes,
that king may or may not be Anne's brother. But right now, the papacy is now dealing with the death of Sixtus IV and the election of Innocent VII. Who is the Pope just before Alexander VI, the Borgia. So we're getting very close to that time.
Oh my god, Lucrezia Borgia.
Yeah. So these early successes for the Borgia regency, however, only stalled the inevitable, and the second half of the 1480s, a civil war broke out known as the Mad War.
Ooh.
And the antagonist of this war was the most powerful man in the kingdom, second only to the king, who was Duke Louis of Orléans.
Thought so.
The spurned Duke. So like his father, Charles the Poet had before him, the Duke of Orléans considered himself a very honourable, upstanding kind of man, and he opposed the harsh and underhanded methods of King Louis the 11th. You know, he's like, he's not a good person, basically. Maybe a good person should be in charge for a change. Which, you know, he has a point. In certain ways.
Yeah, but good people aren't necessarily always good rulers.
They can be. It's not impossible.
Yes, but not always.
But Orléans Olion may or may not get a chance at actually ruling France at a certain point in the future, which we will see. I won't spoil it. I won't get any further into that. Yeah. But for right now, Orléans is the first in line to the throne, should Anne's brother die. Because we've got the Salic Law situation that skips with it. So God. Even if Anne were to have sons, they would not be in line for the throne.
Bollocks.
Yeah, it's bollocks. And for this reason, because Louis is the first prince of the blood, he's gravely insulted by the fact that he's been left out completely from the regency.
Yeah.
So originally he was supposed to be one of the lords governing the realm as the council that Louis had arranged. But by putting Charles in the custody of the Beaujeus, Louis was clearly, you know, saying one thing, doing another, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
As the Spider King often did. So Anne did offer Orléans loads of gifts to, like, shut him up, including she appointed him as the governor of the Île-de-France and Champagne. So he's ruling up in Paris while she's ruling down in the Loire, basically.
That didn't shut him up for long.
Well, no. Orléans remained determined to move against her. He demanded that the Estates General convene to resolve the dispute over who should be the regent. So they met on the 12th of March, 1484. Part of why Orléans did this is because women are forbidden from attending the Estates General.
Oh, bastard.
But Anne, just before the Estates General convened, she temporarily suspended a bunch of the unpopular taxes of her father. So there was this sudden surge in popularity, and her husband, who, you know, represented her at the council, managed to eke out a victory for her supporters.
Nice.
And then it was full steam ahead for arranging the new king's coronation the following May. Nice. So a couple months later. But Orléans is not defeated.
Yeah, he's not happy.
After the coronation, he tries to abduct the king on the way home from his coronation.
Oh, sneaky, sneaky.
So as he leaves Reims, he's going to snap him up. And this is, you know, a tried and true method of seizing a regency, provided your enemies don't immediately find out about it, which Anne did.
She's like, I'm going to put a pin in that.
I mean, among other things, Anne has inherited her father's universal spy network. So she quickly hears about
this. That does help.
And she manages to grab her brother, chuck him on a horse, and ride away into the night with him. So no one knows where they've gone. And they end up popping up back at Amboise, safe and sound.
Yeah.
So at this point, Orléans, everyone knew about his plot. He was humiliated. He had to retire from court.
Nice.
So he just returned to Paris. But his plotting didn't stop there. And he was joined in his plotting by his more ruthless cousin, the Count of Dunois. Now, Dunois is the son of the great war hero, the Bastard of Orléans. So he's from that bastard line of the Orléans family. He's a bit of a scamp. So on behalf of the Orléans faction, Dunois wrote a very provocative open letter to the young king, which was distributed throughout the kingdom. It's basically accused the Beaujeus of mismanaging the finances of the realm and invited Charles VIII to leave his sister and join Orléans in Paris. And this letter from Dunois ended up getting his cousin in big trouble.
Yeah.
So the king, under Anne's direction, of course, responded by firing Orléans from his governorship in Paris, which forced him to flee. And guess where he fled to? I'll give you a few guesses.
Flanders?
Not Flanders. Other direction.
Spain?
No. Not Germany. Quite that far. Not, no.
Holy Roman Empire.
No, he's not outside of modern day France. Where is the court that's like trying to be all independent where like all of the people flee to when they don't like Louis XI? Or
it's not Burgund.
Mm-mm. The other B.
Is it Mary Riches?
Mm-mm. No. Mary the Rich is dead.
Oh. Not Bois, it's not Burgundy.
Where's the rough and tumble fun Celtic place?
Brittany.
Yes, Brittany. Brittany's where everyone goes where they're sick of France, they want to have some fun. So so Orléans flees to Brittany, to the flamboyant court of Duke Francis II.
Oh, it's like going to the beach from the city.
By the way, Antoinette de Manulay, who basically like invented fleeing to Brittany, the royal mistress who we covered, we'll cover in an episode that's coming out after this episode, actually. she is dead, but she kind of invented fleeing to Brittany. So Brittany, as we've seen over the course of Louis the 11th's reign, has been the go-to place for exiles, and Brittany is in its hashtag Free Brittany era. It wants to be independent. It's tired of having to try to suck up to France, which it's kind of been doing throughout the end of the Hundred Years' War. It wants to be its own thing.
Yeah. It's trying to make Fetch happen, but it won't happen.
Yeah. Francis has been fighting his entire life to reestablish Brittany as an independent sovereign state, free from French tyranny. But it wasn't just French exiles at the Breton court. There were also English Lancastrian exiles who had just lost the War of the Roses in England. Or like one of the Wars of the Roses they'd lost. And they were led by one Henry Tudor, the young Welshman, who in 1485, just before war breaks out in Brittany, he manages to sort of get out of Dodge and go back across the Channel, where he defeats Richard III at the Battle of Bosworth and became King Henry VII of England. So we're now at the point where that happens. And the Tudor dynasty begins. By the way, guess who partly financed his expedition and lent him troops?
Louis.
Anne of France.
Oh.
She was very keen to get him out of Brittany and back on the English throne, where she could...
Well, she probably didn't want Louis getting chummy with him.
Yeah, well, yeah. It is funny how, like, he basically goes back to England pretty much just before Louis gets to Brittany. So maybe... You know, Anne, I don't know if Anne could have, like, anticipated that Orleans would flee to Brittany, but it is funny to think about. I don't know,
she knew so many people did. I can just imagine her, like, going, like, oh, quick, send a message, tell him we'll finance him, tell him to get out of there!
Yeah.
Go get your bloody kingdom!
So I bet not many people know that the rise of the Tudor dynasty was in part bankrolled by a French princess, but there you go.
Yeah, fun facts.
Brittany, meanwhile, has rebels of its own to deal with. A lot of internal strife, many of whom aren't afraid to turn to France as a powerful ally. And Anne was quick to use these rebels against the Duke of Brittany.
Why wouldn't you?
Because, by the way, the Duke of Brittany at this point is suffering from what historians have interpreted as early onset dementia. So he's not doing so well mentally.
He's basically a puppet.
Yeah. There's a minister called Pierre Londe, who's very unpopular. He takes over. And there's an uprising, which is led by a number of Breton barons, including François d'Avaugour, the Duke's bastard son, by Antoinette de Manulay, who we covered in a Mistress episode, once again.
Yeah.
But cutting a long story short, the Breton rebels, they successfully seize power. They hanged Brittany's chief minister, Pierre Londe, and they impose a sort of regency council for the Duke, one that was more pro-French than the Breton government had been before. So Anne has kind of succeeded.
Yeah.
But the uprising in Brittany was followed by a counter-uprising when Orléans joins the fray. This then escalates into an all-out civil war that involves the rest of France as well, called the Mad War. The fighting is still confined to Brittany. Yeah, but it's considered a civil war at this point because other French lords are getting involved. Led by Orléans. So it's Orléans and his supporters fighting against Anne and her supporters, but the fighting is happening in Brittany, which is kind of not in France.
It's kind of funny how he's like, Louis has this mentality of, oh, like, you know, a good person should be in charge. I'm like, you're not that good when you're starting a civil war, are you?
Not looking so good anymore. So the Mad War is considered, the actual war itself, the actual fighting is fairly brief. It ends in March 1488, about a year after it starts. And the French have a victory led by Georges de la Tremoille, who is the son of the Georges de la Tremoille, who was the despicable chamberlain of Charles VII. So this La Tremoille was a loyal advisor to Louis XI and an experienced military commander who had led France's successful invasion of Burgundy 10 years earlier.
So he's a good one.
He's experienced. Why? Yeah. So now in Brittany, La Tremoille leads the French to victory at the Battle of Saint-Aubin-du-Cormier, where many Breton nobles are captured, as well as the Duke of Orléans himself.
Nice.
Yes. A month earlier, Orléans had also had all of his property in France confiscated.
That does help.
And we will come back to his ultimate fate in a future episode. Let's just say we haven't seen the last of him.
He's like a cockroach.
Yeah. But for now, the Borgias, they've essentially won and they are now the undisputed regents of France.
Every time you say Borgias, I know you're saying Borgias, but I want to be like, do you mean Borgias? But I'm like, no, they're not even the same thing. But I just feel like they're so close, the name.
Very different spelling.
Yeah, I know.
Well, beau means beautiful in France, and je means game. So they're the beautiful game.
You could take that as a very good, like, you know, it's a beautiful game in terms of, like, you know, of the thrones and stuff.
Yeah. So Anne's coup in Brittany was also aimed at preventing them from allying with France's great new rival, the Austrian Habsburgs.
The hills are alive with the sound of...
He's your cousin. Yeah, but he's my first cousin. Right. So you have your cousins, and then you have your first cousins, and then you have your second cousin.
No, honey.
So we are getting to the Habsburgs now.
Ooh.
At this point, they're by far the biggest headache for France's foreign relations. Their relentless hunger for power, wealth, and territory makes Louis XI look charitable. So Anne wasn't at first an enemy of the Habsburgs. Her brother Charles was already legally married to the Holy Roman Emperor's granddaughter, Margaret von Habsburg.
Oh.
Margaret of Austria.
But...
the marriage hadn't been consummated yet, as she was still very much a child. But Anne had been instrumental in the arrangement of this marriage. She had been the one that Louis XI had sent to Flanders to fetch Margaret of Austria and bring her to France. Because the idea is that she'd be raised as the French court, as the future French queen. Yeah. Similar to the most famous example of this happening is Mary, Queen of Scots. But this became very common practice going into the 16th century.
Yeah. You don't need the support of your family.
It also meant France had a very valuable hostage that they could use against the Habsburgs.
Nice.
Yeah. So Margaret was raised under Anne's care at Amboise, possibly out of fondness for little Margaret, possibly because Margaret's dowry was literally all of Burgundy. She'd inherited from her mother, Mary the Rich.
Nice.
Anne continued to uphold the marriage arrangement throughout her regency, and she treats Margaret sort of like a sister, sort of like a hostage. But marriage or no marriage, Margaret had a pretty embarrassing dad in the form of the future emperor Maximilian, who at this point is the ruler of pesky Flanders. And in true Flanders fashion, he was a major pain in the neck.
Yeah.
So the marriage of his daughter to the King of France didn't stop Maximilian from trying to come to Brittany's aid and surprise attacking Picardy at one point in 1486. Oh. Though he was quickly expelled, he kind of ran out of steam. And he didn't end up linking up with the Bretons. He barely made it into France. Maximilian at this point was determined to get himself married to Duke Francis of Brittany's daughter and heir, Anne of Brittany, which would incorporate Brittany into the Habsburg territory and mean that they bordered France both east and west.
Ooh, that would not be good.
No, Anne does not want this to happen. So after the Mad War, Charles VIII of France and his regents deliver the best possible revenge against the Habsburgs for their meddling. Not only is the marriage with Margaret Habsburg annulled, she is sent packing back to Austria, but also Charles married Anne of Brittany.
Marries Anne, yes!
That Margaret's dad was trying to marry. This definitely makes big enemies out of the Habsburgs, but also...
they did it first.
Yeah, but it's also, you know, worth it, I think.
Poor Marie, though.
You mean Margaret.
Margaret, sorry.
Yeah, they're all the same. But yeah, poor Marie, Margaret. Whatever. Margaret does end up having a successful career elsewhere.
Oh, that's good.
She does end up becoming a very successful governor of the Netherlands. She's appointed governor in her own right later on in her life.
Nice.
And she becomes one of a series of successful female governors of Netherlands. So there we go.
Nice.
Meanwhile, Anne of Brittany, the new queen, is just rolling in. At 11 years old, Anne inherited the Duchy of Brittany from her father. And because Anne of France and her faction had basically taken over Brittany during the Mad War, they took custody of Anne of Brittany and they forced her into marrying Charles when she was about 13.
Well, was Charles?
Charles was 21 at this point.
Okay.
But at this point, his regency does end. It's kind of been extended a bit.
Yeah. Well, it's like Hatshepsut, her and Thutmose III kind of like co-ruled for 10 years when she was meant to give up regency.
Yeah, it's a bit like that. But at this point, Anne of France does back down and is no longer the regent.
Yeah.
And we'll be getting much further into Anne of Brittany and all of this drama around the marriage in her episode, because she is getting an episode. Charles is getting an episode.
Yes.
Yeah. But she's now the Queen of France, as well as the Duchess of Brittany.
Everyone's getting an episode.
So she's very powerful. But continuing with the life of our current Anne that we are focusing on, she ceases to be the regent in 1491 after the marriage.
So how long was she regent for?
We will get to it in Love Beyond the Throne.
We'll get to that later, sorry.
But it's quite a long regency. 8 to 9 years, I believe.
Yeah,
yeah,
nice.
But one historian, John Bridge, who's writing in the 1920s, says that Anne and Charles fell out over the marriage. Like, Anne wanted Charles to stay with Margaret, and then he defied her and he married Anne of Brittany instead. Mm. This is rubbish. This is not true.
Yeah, I can't.
There's no evidence of a falling out. And it was probably actually Anne of France who arranged the marriage with Anne of Brittany as part of her sort of relentless quest to conquer Brittany, which is her one of her main goals in a regency, which she achieved.
It's good when you achieve your goals.
Yes. She pretty much finishes her father's work because Louis XI had been constantly prodding and harassing Brittany. And Anne of France was involved at the marriage at every level. So she carried Anne of Brittany's train at her wedding procession, probably like whispering threats to her from behind.
If you dare turn around.
Holding a shotgun. She also organized the new queen's household, and when the queen fell pregnant, she oversaw arrangements for her confinement. So I doubt she would have been this involved if she'd had a falling out with Charles and she was banished.
Yeah.
She's banished or whatever. So the true reason that the regency ends is because Charles is a freaking adult. He's 21. And a marriage is often used as a convenient rite of passage to phase out a regency. The same thing happened when Charles VI married Isabeau of Bavaria and they had their grand wedding.
Yeah.
It was almost like a second coronation that announced, like, the king is now a man sort of thing.
He has a wife.
And they're screwing. So the timing also makes sense for Anne of France because she is pregnant and she needs to go look after the baby.
Oh.
So she's finally, at the age of 30, she has a second child, a daughter named Suzanne.
Oh.
And from this point, she becomes more focused on parenting Suzanne than parenting her brother.
Suzanne's a new one.
Suzanne is a new name, yes. Also a biblical name. It's just Anne with a bit of Suze at the start. So after the regency, Anne lives between the royal court and the Duchy of Bourbon, which, by the way, her husband has become the Duke of Bourbon, inherited from his elder brother who dies without heirs in 1488. So he becomes Duke Pierre or Peter II of Bourbon. The duchy was supposed to go to the next eldest brother, the Archbishop of Lyon, but
he's a bishop.
Well, there's no rule that bishops can't inherit, but obviously, he's not going to have heirs, so
yeah. So it's kind of
so Pierre forced him to abdicate after 2 weeks, and we can only assume this was on the advice of his ambitious wife. So Anne and her husband are now basically ruling the vast territory of Bourbon.
Nice,
but she didn't leave the French court entirely. She was still regularly visited. She's actually instrumental in the negotiations that lead to the Treaty of Etaples in 1492. So this is the treaty that officially concluded peace talks with England. Now that they're no longer too busy with the Wars of the Roses, Henry VII can now like focus on getting his ducks in a row. And Henry VII had a lot of internal problems to deal with. He was like a usurper king who had all of these rebellions to deal with.
Yep.
So he saw peace with France as very, very valuable. And he seems to have put a lot of trust in Anne because, you know, Anne had supported him to become the king. They're sort of in each other's corner, and thanks to their friendship and their correspondence, they're able to arrange this treaty, which is by many considered like the real end to the Hundred Years' War. It's not really, because there's been no fighting for decades, but there was like a little bit where Edward the Fourth kind of tried to invade France, but he was like quickly bought off by Louis XI. So he basically gave him some money so he could leave. So the war's kind of been over, but now it's like officially over in 1492.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, we've reached the discovery of America as well, which is more relevant to just Spain at this point, but will become relevant to France. Unfortunately, as France does the whole colonialism thing. But, you know, that's in the future. So if Anne did have grievances with her brother, again, I don't think they fell out, but if she was a bit mad at something, it was probably the fact that one of his first acts as king was to cede a bunch of eastern territories to the Habsburgs in compensation for breaking off the marriage with Margaret.
No.
Yeah, so they ceded Artois, Charolais, and Franche-Comté, which had been part of Margaret's dowry inheritance sort of thing. So they are losing that, but they're gaining Brittany, which is pretty big. And they're ensuring that with the marriage of Anne to Anne of Brittany, I should say, to the king, that's making it so that their heir will be the heir to both France and Brittany and like officially unite them. So I think it's a net positive, but they do have to sacrifice some territory for this.
Anne's territory.
Huh?
Anne's territory, you mean?
Well, it's really Margaret's territory. It wasn't, hadn't been like incorporated to the royal domain. Also, Anne is not the regent of France anymore. Her territory is Bourbon, so she couldn't care less.
But I thought that's part of the dowry. Was that Anne of Brittany's dowry?
No. Anne of Brittany has Brittany. Margaret's dowry was the eastern territories that they had to then give back to the Habsburgs. But it's because, but it's because the king rejected Margaret and married Anne of Brittany that he had to give away that lands that were part of Margaret's dowry, if that makes sense. Because you can't keep her dowry if you're rejecting her. And...
Also, Margaret's dowry. I thought you said it was Anne's dowry.
Sorry, I'm sorry that was confusing.
Yeah, I thought you said it was Anne's. Then I was like, why the hell do they have to give Anne's dowry away?
But the good news is that both Maximilian, who's a widower, and his daughter, who's now single, are now like floundering around for different allies since they've lost the French marriages. So 3 years later in 1494, when Charles VIII went on a big expedition to Italy, which we will get to it in much further detail in his episode. It's a very exciting time because we're at the height of the Renaissance. We've got the Sforzas, the Medicis, the Borgias causing all kinds of problems in Italy. Nice. And Charles just jumps into the fray of that. But we'll get into that in his episode. He just comes rolling in with a bunch of cannons. And it's fun. Like, but we'll get to it. But meanwhile, who is left as the regent of France? Who did a great job last time and is made regent again? Anne.
I mean, when in doubt.
Anne of Brittany could have been made the regent. But she's
preggers?
Well, she's not preggers, but she's still considered like foreign and they don't really trust her because she has her own territory that has its own interests that are kind of anti-French interests. So she's not trusted at all. And Charles orders that her household gets moved into Anne's household at Moulin in Bourbon. Oh. So the royal court fully just moves to Bourbon and Anne controls it. And her husband is reappointed as Lieutenant General. But really, this means that Anne is the regent again.
Nice.
And this is by no means a downgrade for the royal court. So with the Bourbon finances now behind her, Anne was the richest woman in France. And she even lent the king 10,000 livres to help finance the war.
Nice.
So she's the king's debtor now.
She's rolling.
Yeah, she's rolling in it.
In money.
Now, we'll obviously see in Charles VIII's episode whether he is successful in Italy. I'll say no more about that. Or the rest of his reign. But with France now at peace at home, Anne's brief second regency is a success. So after this, after about another year as the regent, she retires more and more from court, though she is an avid letter writer who is always keen to lend a guiding hand in political matters. And she's very busy doing sort of reforms and rulership in Bourbon as well. I will, however, skim over the political events that happen through the rest of Anne's life. She lives another 30 years, but isn't really directly involved in any major events. There are a lot of major events, but we can't get into them because spoilers. But, you know, Anne had plenty to occupy herself in Bourbon. And she was also focused on the upbringing, inheritance, and prospective future marriage of her only child, Suzanne. She does have what is suspected to be another pregnancy, perhaps even giving birth to a son in 1497 in her late 30s. But the child is still born, and from this point she seems to give up on having more children, because from this point she puts all of her eggs in the Suzanne basket. And to this effect, Anne writes a book called Lessons for My Daughter, which is basically like a big manual about like leadership and morality that she gives to Suzanne. It's written shortly after Anne's latest pregnancy, which sort of was very life-threatening. So Anne wanted to like have all of her thoughts written down for Suzanne to follow in case she should meet a, quote, imminent, sudden, or early death. But, you know, Anne lives a long time after that, which is quite funny. So meanwhile, Anne managed to cleverly negotiate with a future king of France, who we will get to agree to recognize Suzanne as the heir to all of her parents' titles. Including the Duchy of Bourbon, which previously had only been passed through men.
Nice.
Yeah. And at this point, Suzanne now became Europe's most valuable bride. It was Mary the Rich, then it was Anne of Brittany, and now it is Suzanne of Bourbon, is the Regina George of the royal princesses in Europe. So not only was she the heiress of France's richest duchy at the time, she was also the closest unmarried relative to the King of France. So she would be valuable just as a French alliance overall. And Charles, during his various campaigns in Italy and stuff, did kind of dangle her in front of people at certain points. She was considered...
Like, maybe.
She was considered at one point for the King of Naples. She was considered at one point for one of the Sforzas in Milan. But to prevent future conflict, she didn't end up getting married within France.
Okay.
Pierre was gunning for her to marry his friend, Duke Charles of Alençon, who's like another royal cousin. But Anne opposed this, and Pierre conveniently died before the marriage with Alençon could take place. So Suzanne ended up marrying a different Charles, Count Charles of Montpensier. He was the next senior most male of the Bourbon family. So he was the kind of like second or third cousin. So if the Bourbon duchy was just following the male line, he would have inherited. And she's the exact same age as Suzanne. They're about 11 at this point. Yeah. So Anne thinks this would be great because it would prevent future conflicts within the Bourbon family of like him feeling like spurned because she's taken over. So she gets them married, and this is a very successful marriage.
Oh, that's good.
They get along pretty well. And at 12 years old, Suzanne inherits everything from her father, who dies at the age of 65 in 1503. And by 14, she was fully married to Montpensier.
Yeah.
So Anne now has yet another regency. This time she's fully ruling over Bourbon because both Suzanne and her husband are too young. And at this point, Anne's main job is defending her daughter's lands from encroachment by the King of France, which is a constant problem as the kings continue to try to centralize and take power from the princes. At this point, Charles VIII is dead. It's a different king, but we'll get to him. Anne lives all the way into the reign of Francis I, who is also trying to steal Bourbon lands as well. But skipping forward now about 20 years, Anne's line sadly did not continue with Suzanne.
Aww.
She'd been pregnant several times, but not managed to produce a living child. And she died 2 days before her 30th birthday in 1521. Aww. So her husband, Charles, fought to keep the lands in the family, and Anne fought to ensure that he would continue the Bourbon line because she saw him as a son at this point.
Yeah.
And Anne was left to govern Bourbon, actually, while Montpensier went off for yet another Italian campaign, which, again, we'll get to. But Anne wasn't, unfortunately, long for this world after her daughter's death, and she died a year and a half later on the 14th of November, 1522, of natural causes at the Chateau de Chantel, which is her favourite castle.
How old?
She was 61, which is the exact same age as her father had been when he died.
Damn.
So she's very much the spitting image of Louis XI. So having ruled Bourbon for many years, Anne was buried in the traditional burial place of the Dukes of Bourbon at the Souvigny Priory, alongside her husband Pierre and her daughter Suzanne. So they're all buried together. Unfortunately, the tombs at Souvigny were destroyed during the French Revolution.
Oh, yeah. They always are.
Yeah. I mean, they aren't always destroyed during the French Revolution, but Bourbon becomes very much a name associated with the old regime that the the peasants aren't happy with. So Souvigny is one of the first targets when the revolution gets to the south of France. Yeah. Charles of Montpensier unfortunately died not long after, and he was childless. So the Bourbon lands ended up going to a totally different branch of the Bourbon family. There's a lot of Bourbons running around. But we will eventually get to that other branch in future episodes. They may or may not end up becoming the royal family at a future point after the Valois. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Mm-hmm. So it's now time to rate Anne of France and see how she stacks up compared to our kings. So first getting into Enchanté.
Enchanté.
Okay, I'm going to show you a triptych of images. So these are three images together that were all painted the same time and meant to be displayed alongside each other. So Anne of France, she has two famous portraits, both of which are part of devotional images. So these are kinds of portraits that show the patron of the artwork kneeling in the foreground in front of a saint or a biblical figure in the background. This is a very popular 15th century thing that, like, you know, French nobles or Italian merchants had painted of themselves in the early Renaissance. This is by the Netherlandish painter Jan Hay, who was a favorite artist at both the royal court and Anne's court at Moulin. The first of these on the left is Pierre or Peter of Bourbon with Saint Peter, the saint that he's named after, which is quite fun. Then in the center, we've got Suzanne, their daughter. And then on the right, we've got Anne with John the Baptist.
Suzanne has such chubby cheeks. They're just so pinchable.
Sorry, not John the Baptist. John the Evangelist. There's lots of Johns.
Isn't there always?
Yeah, Suzanne is very, very cute. She's got very pinchable cheeks. And Anne, as you can see, is she's dressed in a kind of sort of modest, but clearly...
But lavish at the same time.
Lavish at the
like,
same
it's
time.
It's like the subtle lavish vibes. Like, you know, you're trying to be modest, but the like you know, the quality of the...
It's classy.
It's like the quality. Yeah, it's just the quality of like the furs and the fabrics, but it looks modest. It's like, oh.
Yeah.
It's kind of like you look and you think, oh, it's modest. But then when you look close, you're actually like, damn, that's super expensive.
Yeah. So for listeners who can't see, she's wearing this big black veil. But down the, her front, she's got this, like, bejeweled decorative.
And her, like, sleeves are fur trim.
Yeah, she's got ermine trim.
Around the sleeves.
Yeah, she's classy, she got something. But definitely very wealthy.
Yeah.
She is dressed kind of extravagantly in a second triptych, which is the altarpiece for Moulin Cathedral, the cathedral at capital of Bourbon.
Yeah.
This is once again her and Pierre either side of... The central image, which is a Virgin Mary image.
Oh, with her daughter.
And she's got her daughter behind her this time.
In like a little mini. Oh my God, it's like matching mum and dad.
They have matching outfits. It's very cute. They're both wearing these red and white matching outfits with like a gold thing down the front. And these little crowns as well, these little coronets.
Oh, that is adorable. As well. Like when I'm teaching and I see the Japanese moms with their little bubs in their matching outfits or the siblings in matching outfits. And I'm like, oh my God.
Also, Pierre once again has St. Peter behind him, and this time Anne has St. Anne behind her.
Nice.
They've got their namesakes behind them. Both of these, they're by the same artist, Jan Hay. The first one was around 1492-1493. It was made, so between Anne's two regencies, when they retired at Moulin. It later entered the royal collection. It's now in the Louvre. The Moulin triptych, so the second more extravagant image, was intended to be hung over the altar at Moulin Cathedral. It was commissioned around 1498-99, shortly before Pierre's death. Mm. And apparently it's still in that cathedral today. The nearby Musée Anne de Beaujeu, which is a significant art museum in Bourbon, is named after Anne.
Nice.
Yeah, she's got this artistic legacy for sure. So these works are excellent examples of the Northern Renaissance style, which is... unprecedented in terms of realism. The figures do tend to have this sort of uncanny, kind of doll-like appearance to our modern eyes.
Yeah.
But because Anne's appearance is pretty consistent in both of these works, you can get a very good idea of how she would have looked. The red outfit is probably kind of the most extravagant thing she owned, whereas the black outfit is probably more what she would have worn day to day. It's very kind of modest, demure kind of style.
I like it.
In terms of other forms of patronage, Anne can be credited with moving the court to Amboise, which becomes a very significant royal castle. She transformed it into a formal court setting, which drew influence from the refinement of the Burgundian court. And nice. Indeed, it probably appropriated funds that had been raided from Burgundy at the end of Louis XI's reign.
May as well.
Then that was built on by future rulers as well, including Anne of Brittany. So Anne's tomb may not survive, but after the revolution, she was remembered as one of the great women of French history, and she was commemorated in similar ways to kings and queens that we've previously discussed. So there is a statue of Anne. She's one of the many statues in the Jardin du Luxembourg in Paris. I'll show you the statue. Nice.
Yes, show me.
It's pretty much exactly modeled off the Moulin triptych. And when I say Moulin, that is Moulin like Moulin Rouge, not Moulin like the Chinese warrior.
Yeah, that was the first thing that popped in my mind when you said it the first time. I was like, I know it's not connected to the amazing musical.
It's like the French word for windmill. Windmills, there's an S in the end. But yeah, this is the statue of Anne. Facially, it's not like her at all, but the outfit is very much modeled off the Moulin painting.
Oh yeah, the outfit, yeah.
Yeah.
She looks like a boss.
She is a boss. And she's depicted among many other boss women. Also in this park, there's a statue of Saint Genevieve, the patron saint of Paris. And there is the mini version of the Statue of Liberty in this park as well.
Oh.
In case you don't know, there is a mini Statue of Liberty in Paris.
Well, it was French.
Because, yeah, the French want to make it absolutely clear that they made it.
Made it?
Yeah. Appearance-wise, Anne was never considered a beauty, but she was admired for her upright demeanor. And she took advantage of her kind of severe features and her intense stare to sort of strike fear into people at court. She very much had this very bold presence, and I think that's kind of reflected in her depictions.
Nice, I like that.
So what do we want to give Anne for Enchanté?
She's a pleasant surprise.
I will note she's the first real like Renaissance patron that we are discussing. True. Definitely Anne of Brittany takes us to a different level. Anne of Brittany is kind of considered like the first great Renaissance woman of France, but Anne definitely has shades of that, and she was very influential for Anne of Brittany, so...
True. Like a six?
A six?
Why?
I was going to go seven. I think it's quite good. I think she starts off a lot of things that are pretty significant.
Yeah, I'll go 6.5.
Okay, so that is a 13.5 for Enchanté. Moving on to En Garde.
En Garde.
So as a child, Charles VIII stood in awe of his big sister, who with one look could command him from across the room. She had this kind of bewitching...
piercing gaze.
Yeah, she had this kind of hold over both Charles and over her husband as well. So much so that whenever he made a decision, and he made a lot of very important decisions, it was usually understood to be her decision. With the possible exception of their daughter's marriage, they did dispute over who she should marry, but that was more of an outlier than the rule.
And Anne won.
I'll just do a brief list of some of Anne's achievements, and let me know if you think of any others, Eliza. So she's the one woman in French history who rules the country without being a queen. So she's neither a queen mother nor a queen consort. It was a very successful regency. She won a civil war. That was not really even a civil war. It was mainly fought in Brittany. She lowered taxes very effectively. That was a temporary measure. It didn't really impact the finances too much. This gave her sort of time and space to kind of solidify her father's reforms. It's really because of her that Louis XI's policies ended up becoming a long-term thing that could have sort of carried forward and get immediately destroyed.
Yeah, as it usually does.
Yeah. She improved the court. She made it a more desirable place to live, to curry the favor of the nobles, which her father had failed to do. And she crushed and humiliated her rival Orléans. She captured him. And over the course of this civil war, she just casually also took over Brittany.
yes, you do.
Preventing a Habsburg takeover of Brittany, which would have been disastrous for France. To top it off, she brings peace with England. She helps win the Wars of the Roses by sponsoring Henry VII. So the Tudor dynasty might not exist without Anne of France. So she makes a big impact. And then after that, she is relentless in like fighting for her own selfish wins in Bourbon. And
Love
continually sort of outfoxes future kings of France and kind of keeps them in her pocket.
Like yeah. that.
But I didn't get too far into that because I don't want to spoil future events that happen. But let's just say yeah. Anne continues as a formidable figure all the way into Francis I's reign.
Good little boss lady. She was...
Yeah. Is there anything we might say are negatives for En Garde?
Well, I guess you'd say she did contribute to a civil war.
Mm.
Other than that, it did result in her winning, so it doesn't really matter.
Also, you could definitely argue that the war was already very much brewing by the time she came to power.
True.
Louis XI pissed off a lot of people just before he died.
It's not my problem.
But she's successful, and it's net it ends up with a net positive for France. She does lose those eastern territories which Margaret would have brought in, but she gets Anne of Brittany, who's like seen as kind of the bigger prize for her brother.
I think she did well. Like, she ensured her daughter had a good, I know her daughter didn't live, but tried to make as many good decisions for her family as possible.
Yeah. I mean, she literally got a law change so that her daughter could inherit Bourbon. She got Bourbon changed from a royal appanage so that it would go back to the crown after the male line ran out, or it would just go to a male cousin. She got that changed to making it a fiefdom, which means that it's its own thing, which can make its own inheritance rules.
Yeah, it's
so it's pretty good. Significant. It's pretty good.
It is pretty good. I think we should give a hard marks for this.
She's so effective that she then becomes the regent again. One caveat is that she's never really the regent. Like, it's always her husband who has the official role. The title of regent is never actually given to anyone. It's generally... It's kind of like an unspoken fact that she is the true power, which I think is kind of powerful in itself. Like, she doesn't need the title.
It is.
Everyone just knows that she's...
Everyone knows.
The main...
In charge.
The head honcho.
I do like that.
She kind of has that sort of mafia-esque thing that her dad had.
She does. I do love that. I do love that. I think she did very well on her personal goals, so I think we should give her high for this.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of, you know, the scene in Avatar Last Airbender when Azula is confronting the chief minister guy.
Oh, yeah.
She's like, one of us is going to be sitting in that throne. All of these soldiers don't know who that's going to be, but you know, and I know.
I know. Yes.
And then she just goes and sits in the chair. Yeah, that's very much Anne's kind of vibe. She's like, we all know who's in charge. We all know it's me. Yeah. No one's going to say it.
True, true.
No one's going to officially write that down on a piece of paper.
But we all know.
But we all know. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I think we should give a high, like 8 or 9.
Ooh. 9 is what her dad got. I think I'd be comfortable giving her an 8. She doesn't have quite as many achievements as her dad.
Yeah.
But considering...
considering the time and her gender.
She's a woman... Might be 8.5 or 9 territory. Because of that mitigating factor, because of where she starts, because she's not a queen. Yeah, maybe she should get a 9.
Yeah, I'm going to go for 9.
Yeah, I'm going to give her a 9. Blanche of Castile got a 9.5. She's the highest scoring woman in this category. I don't think Anne of France is quite the level, that echelon. Yeah.
Close.
But close. Yeah. So that's an 18 for En Garde, doing extremely well so far, is Anne of France.
Yeah.
Now let's see how she does in Voulez-vous.
Voulez-vous?
While Anne took after her father in many ways, she diverges from him a bit in this round. It's true that she didn't like sort of excess or ostentatiousness, but as can kind of be seen from her portraits, she understood the need for a royal pageantry that had been lacking at the court of Louis XI.
Keep people happy.
She also made the court a more cultured and intellectual place. Again, she's taking after the legacy of the Burgundian court, and her feminine touch made it a better environment for young girls.
Yay.
So Anne ensured that all of the young women of her court had tutors to teach them arts, languages, mathematics, and hunting as well.
Nice.
All skills that they would need as future courtiers and consorts. Anne was also the main arbitrator when it came to marrying a lot of these girls off to suitable husbands.
Nice.
So her court became a kind of finishing school for young debutantes, which included two girls who will get future episodes from us.
Ooh.
We've got Louise of Savoy, who will be a future regent of France. And we've got Diane de Poitiers, who's a future royal mistress.
Oh.
Both of them are brought up at Anne's court and obviously learned a lot from her. And we've also got Margaret of Austria. Even though she doesn't become the Queen of France, she is raised at the French court under Anne.
True.
And she does also benefit from her mentorship. And as we mentioned, she becomes a very successful governor in the Netherlands.
True, true.
Policy-wise, Anne's regency was popular with the people due to her temporary lowering of taxes. The taxes had been particularly harsh towards the end of Louis XI's reign, so this was much needed.
Yeah.
Also, the civil war, which was fought between her and Orléans, was mainly confined to Brittany. Didn't have didn't a huge effect on France's prosperity.
That's good.
Which continued to steadily grow after the Hundred Years' War. We finally see the administrative reforms of Louis XI start to sort of pay off during this time.
Nice.
And it's quite a prosperous time for France.
That's good.
Speaking of which, it was Anne who brought about the official peace with England, the Treaty of Etaples, where it means that they're constantly fearing an English invasion.
They just fear Austrian.
Yeah. And this is also very good for, like, trade and, you know, all sorts of things. She's also remembered very fondly in Bourbon for her and her husband's improvement of the local administration. They improved the roads. Yes. They unified those territories under one law code. Because originally it was a bunch of different titles that the Bourbons had kind of cobbled together over time. It includes other regions like Auvergne and Carlisle. And So they're bringing just them all together, kind of centralizing them, and also making the French language the language of law, because there are like three local dialects that are kind of competing. Unfortunately, this does mean that these dialects die out, but it does improve the effectiveness of how the language is administered.
Yeah, the efficiency.
Yeah,
that is good.
Anne's main legacy that's endured to this day is her book, Lessons for My Daughter, which is addressed to Suzanne, but by writing down and publishing the lessons, it's also clear that Anne intended for it to, for a wider audience.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's definitely part of her whole sort of teach the children kind of mentality. She's very much a pedagogue in her mentality. So to our eyes, the lessons are pretty backward, unfortunately. They include some basic points of etiquette that all young princesses would need to learn. So to quote Sharon Jansen's summary, avoid making faces, refrain from running or jumping, say your prayers every morning, pay attention in church, keep your fingers out of your nose, dress warmly when the weather is cold. So these are the kinds of things that are in there.
That one is pretty good advice, Jeff. Swarm when the weather is cold and keep your finger under your nose.
Yeah, it's pretty good ones. Not bad advice, but things do get more profound and scary. So Anne teaches her daughter to be dutiful, to not give in to silly ideas like love, which would lead her astray and compromise her virtue.
Yeah, I can see that as being fair. I agree with that.
It's very different to the Eleanor of Aquitaine school of marriage is wicked and it's all about love. But Anne is like,
no love.
If you give in to love, it must be to your husband. And also, Suzanne was encouraged to live in the constant knowledge that she could die at any moment and face God's judgment. So it's a pretty
morbid.
It's a pretty tough love.
God, that'd be
approach.
Yeah, imagine that having your mother tell you, like, you could die at any moment.
Anne is quite intense, let's just say. And this book sort of combines her strong spirituality with her sort of almost Machiavellian politics. This is also where we get her commentary on dressing humbly, which she saw as a virtue. Other virtues are patience, pleasing the family of one's husband. Mm. Also, always asking for and following the advice of one's friends or mentors.
Well, that's a good one.
It's not bad advice. She also tells Suzanne that when she has daughters of her own, she should not try to compete with them. And that older women, rather than trying to look or act younger, they're better off, quote, finding some useful pastime.
True. It is a bit sad when you see, like, you know, quite old people and they're trying to dress like they're in their 20s. And you're like, I love you have the confidence for that, but try a different style, please.
There is a lot of, like, internalized misogyny in a lot of this. But, you know, it's the 15th century. Like, what do you expect?
It's hard to be write a full-on manifesto about, you know, women independence. Like, you know, you can't really publish that
exactly
in this time.
But this all is written in mind of like, Suzanne, you're going to be a ruler and you're going to be married. You're going to start a dynasty. Like, it's, you know, it's very sad because ultimately Suzanne dies quite young and
before her
has children, but they all die. Yeah, it's a bit sad, but this, the lessons do contain a lot of useful stuff. I think the best piece of advice that Anne gives is, quote, "You are not a fool unless you think you are wise."
Ah, that is.
So you've got to always question your own thinking and not get too cocky.
Yeah, don't think you're the bee's knees.
Exactly. Outside of this one work, Anne was a huge patron of culture, arts, and literature. She's one of the first real Renaissance women. Her possessions included a treasure trove of jewels, plates, and illuminated manuscripts that she's basically hoarded from, like, her mother, her father, and the Bourbon family.
Oh, she's like a dragon.
She's very much a dragon.
I love it.
Or maybe a magpie.
I like a magpie.
She inherited 138 manuscripts from her mother, Charlotte, which included religious prayer books, chivalric romances, which Anne said should be read with caution, history books, books about good governance, classics by Cicero, Boethius, Boccaccio, and Christine de Pizan, who is a major influence over Anne and her own writing, since she is a woman writing advice to other women, which is mainly what Christine did. Anne, of course, expanded this collection, and by the time of her death, there were 324 books. So they were more than double the collection.
Nice.
And across six languages as well, all of which Anne spoke to some degree or other.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah. So Anne, I would say she has a net positive effect for France and French culture, prosperity of the kingdom, even though she can be rather harsh, particularly to other women. But it's undeniable that her role in teaching and preparing the next generation of princesses and queens plays a huge role in France's flourishing in the 16th century. Because it's these women who are like the patrons of all of the beautiful things that we see from this period.
True, true, true.
So what do we want to give for Voulez-Vous?
I would want to live in her, like, domain.
She's very strict. She wouldn't be an easy boss to work for.
But she wouldn't be, like, giving you unreasonable things.
Yeah.
Like, she wouldn't make unreasonable demands, like, you know, I can't think of 15th century unreasonable demand. Oh, I know, find a unicorn or slay a mythical beast, but, you know.
She's taking the more like feminine mercy of her mother and combining it with the fatherlessness of her father and making a lovely cocktail that kind of makes a perfect ruler in a way.
And she did that very well.
She's not perfect. She is quite severe.
Yeah.
But
compared to some of the previous rulers, I wouldn't mind living under her.
I think it's kind of what France needs because Charles VIII, we'll get to him.
They need a bit of tough love.
Yeah, Charles VIII, we'll get to him. He does need a bit of tough love, and he's a little bit of a pushover, but...
a bit of a fool.
Anne's always kind of there in the background to kind of, like, nudge him in the right direction.
She's that good advisor. I'm thinking, like, an 8?
I'll agree with 8. I think 8's a good score. So, 8 I always think of in Voulez-Vous as, like, it's entering great reform territory. And she definitely does bring in great reforms, especially when it comes to Bourbon. And the prosperity that it has under her rule. So that's 16. A 16 for Voulez-Vous.
Nice.
Moving on to Ooh La La.
Ooh La La.
Now, I don't have much here. Part of Anne's grasp on power was based on the fact that she avoided scandal at any turn. She was very upright and poised and, like, did not get herself involved in petty squabbles.
All that ridiculous notion of love.
But even though we'd see her as a bit stuffy, to our persuasion, she was very controversial at the time.
She was scandalous for being a woman.
Yeah, she was seen as, like, controlling and, like, manlike. She was accused of being, because, you know, if a man does a set of things, he's praised, but if a woman does a set of things, she is denigrated.
Yes.
And she's seen as a continuation of her father and his, like, tyranny or whatever.
Da-da-da.
Even though I would argue she's kind of a softening of that.
Do we have any scandal?
No bedroom shenanigans, no whispers of anything, no murders, really.
No gigolos.
No gigolos. But she just does have this general threateningness, which I kind of like.
We can't say that's scandal, though.
But you could say she caused a stir. by being as powerful as she was.
She did contribute to a civil war. But that was going to happen either way, even without her.
But her dispute with Orleon is juicy. The way they're kind of one-upping each other. Mm-hmm. And she just destroys him.
I do love a bit of distraction.
There's a lot of juicy stuff in there. It's juicy vibes.
If it was for Orleans, he'd be getting, like, quite a few scandalicious points for, like, you know, civil war and trying to kidnap the king, but she just squashes him like a bug.
Yeah.
So she quells that scandaliciousness. She's like, not in my court.
I'm thinking it's, like, just, like, below five, but not, like, a one. Maybe, like, a two, a three, or four. That's what I'm thinking.
You're way too generous. I was thinking like a 0.5.
Oh, gosh.
Besides her being a woman, there's just nothing scandalous. Oh, I will give her a point for like letting that Margaret's like basically being like, we don't need you anymore, Margaret. Be gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I've raised you for like your entire childhood. But yeah, you're out now. Bye-bye.
Yeah. You're no longer useful to me.
She did get, like, the best education ever, so there's that, but...
There's that, yeah. Bounce.
I've done enough for you. Be gone. Your dad is being a bitch.
Go home and cry to your father. I'll have no tears in this court.
She's very much like that. I can imagine, like, maybe, like, later on in her life, I can imagine Maggie Smith playing her.
Yes. Yeah. Oh my God, I can just imagine her as, like, absolutely hating any of those White Lotus type characters. And she's kind of like, stop with your weeping to get your way. Just come out and say it.
Yeah.
Get straight to the point. Don't be all wishy-washy.
Oh, the French nobility are just all people, like people from White Lotus. And Anne's having none of it.
Well, I was thinking more the character type of a White Lotus.
Right.
You know, where they're all like, oh, poor me. But they're really just scheming, like,
so what do we want to give for Ooh La La? I think there's a healthy amount of skullduggery there that I want to give her a few points.
Yeah, you've convinced me. I want to give her a few. I'm thinking three. One for, like, the be gone to Margaret. One for her, like, literally changing a whole law for her daughter. Yeah. I'm like, it's pretty, like, that's scandalous.
One or two, I would say, for being a controversial woman who overstepped the boundaries of her gender. Scandalous at the time.
I'm going to go for three.
Yeah, I think I might go four. I'm always more generous. Yeah. I'm always the more generous one. But I just think she's got...
Which is funny because usually I'm definitely more generous in scandal, but...
Yeah, I kind of like the image of she's got this like upright, like properness, but she's behind the scenes. She's very like...
But she's like, but in the same way she's quite just like, she doesn't have a mask. She's just, she shows you what you, like, what's that saying?
This is a matter of dispute for chroniclers where some are like, when she's showing her good side, people are like, oh, it's just a mask, she's evil. But the reality probably is she's just a complex human, but she is straightforward. Yeah.
She just had a straightforward blonde personality. It was like, I'm not going to take anyone's shit.
Yeah. For not taking anyone's shit, I think that is worth a whole point in itself. So I'm giving her a four.
Going three.
Okay. So that is a seven for Ooh La La.
I totally feel like her and Princess Anne, like current Princess Anne of England, would get along swell.
Yeah. Especially they go on amazing horse rides together.
Yeah.
Trying to outdo each other.
And then they just feel like, at the same time, they'd be like, oh, useless brothers.
I was like, oh, is she an ancestor of Princess Anne? I was like, no, because she doesn't have any descendants. Yeah. A great aunt or something.
Yeah.
Or cousin. Yeah.
They're a common ancestor.
Yeah, there is definitely a common ancestor. There are many common ancestors.
Something removed all, by all however many. Together.
Anyway, okay, we have to get on because this episode is becoming too long. So, Le Vie on Throne. So Anne,
how long?
She ruled France as the unofficial regent from her father Louis XI's death on the 30th of August 1483, up to around the time her brother Charles VIII's marriage, which happened on the 6th of December 1491. So if we take those exact dates, it's 8 years, 4 months, and 7 days. But then her second regency, while Charles is away in Italy, lasts from vaguely September 1494 to July 1495. So that adds another 10 months. So altogether, that's just over 9 years. And that's 1.8 points for Vie on Throne. So it's not great compared to kings, but it's pretty decent for a regent.
Yeah.
We are at a crossroads, though, since Anne is also a ruler in her own right. So she owned substantial feudal territories in central France, as well as being the regent of Bourbon after her husband's death. So in that sense, she's comparable to Eleanor of Aquitaine, who we gave points for based on being the Duchess of Aquitaine, not based on being the Queen of France. Because it seemed like the most fair thing to do, because like that's how she was a ruler in her own right.
Yeah.
With that in mind, let's see what Anne would get if we rated her by the same metric.
Okay.
So Anne is first granted the status of a feudal lord when her father makes her the Countess of Gien in 1481. Apparently this is to offset her household expenses. She's probably buying too many horses.
Too many books.
Too many books. And she holds these lands up until her death on the 14th of November, 1522, which altogether is about 41 years.
Nice.
Yeah. So if we were to rate this as a reign, that would give her 7.7 points, which is nothing to scoff at.
Wow.
But as a compromise between these two, between like the regency score and that score, if you agree, because she is both a regent and a ruler in her own right, I think I'm going to give her full scores for being regent of all of France, and then half scores for her own territory.
Okay. Yeah, I'll take that.
And then combine those two, similar to how we've done with the Merovingians.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think if we have future regents that also are rulers of something else, we could do it this way as well, maybe. Comes to a total score of 5.6 points.
Not too bad.
And unfortunately, she doesn't get points for children because she sadly didn't outlive Suzanne. Suzanne died a year and a half before her. So just missed out on a Vie on Throne point there. So that is 5.6 out of 20 for La Vie on Throne. Now, to tally up the final score, are we ready? 60.1.
Oh my god, that is like, isn't that amazing? Because didn't she live to 61?
She did live to 61. 60.1.
Oh my god.
Yeah. She is below her father, Louis the 11th. Mainly because Louis got a lot more Vie on Throne points.
Yeah.
She is just narrowly above Charles the Wise, Charles the V of France.
Huh.
She's around that same. Both loved book learning, so that's good.
Nice.
If you're a nerd, you get a 60 thereabouts. So with that said, where shall we put Anne? Because with the in-betweeny people, we decide whether they belong where they belong in the grandstand, watching the final tournament as spectators.
I think VIP.
Yeah. I think she does deserve to be in the VIP because she's very much an unsung hero of French history. She doesn't get a lot of airtime. She's always overshadowed by Anne of Brittany.
I'm going to cross-stitch her now.
Yeah. Eliza's going to cross-stitch her. I think she belongs in the Hall of Fame among the great regents of France. So congratulations. Yeah. Anne of France and Anne de Beaujeu, you are now in the VIP box.
Yay.
Speaking of the VIP box, we have some patrons to thank. Since we've begun our Mistress series. By the way, Agnes Sorel will have been out the week before this episode comes out, and Antoinette de Manulet will be the week after. So both the mistresses of Charles the VII, so Anne's grandfather. We're finally getting to them. So in the boudoir, joining us in their new mistress tier, we've got Amanda Chadwick and Kirby Carlson. And in the Economy Plus tier, we've also had a couple other people joining. We've got Caleb Burns for Turbo and Tina Johnston. So thank you guys for joining us.
Claps.
Also have a correction from last episode, which thank you, Henri from Facebook, for correcting me. when I was describing the operation that Louis did an experiment of, if you remember, he had like this prisoner who he released on the condition that he would do a gallstone operation.
Oh, yeah.
The operation that I described was actually a bladder stone, or was it a kidney stone? It was a different kind of stone. It's a procedure that didn't exist for another couple hundred years. So I'm not a scientist. So the gallstone operation, I think, is a bit different.
My friend had to get it done recently.
I don't think it involved the horrible method that I described. I think it was more of just a direct, you know, what we would think of as an
cut and grab operation.
Yeah. Still have no idea whether or not the guy survived it or whether or not it was successful. I still have no idea. couldn't find any further stuff on that other than a brief thing on Wikipedia. So if you guys know, let me know. But anyway, yes. That's a little addendum.
I'm always interested in that.
To the Spider King at the end. So with that said, any last thoughts, Eliza? Any advice for the end of the episode, as this is an episode about a woman giving advice?
She was pretty good. She didn't do anything wrong. Like, she didn't fall off a horse.
No, she was very good at not falling off horses.
She didn't go into Spooky Forest, where she is then assassinated. So points for her for that, I'd say. But in general, just live a good life. Eat that cake if you want to eat that cake. Do exercise if you want to exercise, or just live your life.
And don't overlook successful badass women, because they'll sneak up behind you and take over your kingdom. All right, so that's going to be all from me.
Goodbye from me.